This is the Inland Journal. I'm Doug Nadvornik, this week with a co-host.
Hi, Doug. I'm Tom MacArthur. About a year ago, my friend Phil Tyler and I created a discussion group that we initially called Leaders Without Labels. The idea was that people with differing political beliefs can meet and talk about issues on which we disagree and yet still respect and honor one another. We meet once a month to talk about what's going on in our lives and about what's in the news. I extended an invitation to my friend Doug Nadvornik to join us. Together, we've nurtured an idea that a discussion group like this might work on the radio. Not long ago, we changed the name of the group to Spokane Plus One, to reflect the notion that each of us should bring a friend to join the discussion. And so, we invite you to listen in to this conversation and perhaps join us on the radio for a future discussion.
This is our pilot program, and it's very timely. Last week, we heard the news that Washington State University student and football player Tyler Helinski shot and killed himself in his Pullman apartment. When the news broke that night, it hit me hard. I never met Tyler. I don't know his parents. And yet, as a father myself, it struck me that could have been one of my kids. And I immediately thought of Phil Tyler, whose son recently ended his own life. Just the week before, as it turns out, this group had taped a discussion that started with that tragic event, and it morphed into something much deeper. We start the conversation by introducing you to our panel members.
I'm Joe. I'm the oldest guy in the room, I noticed, and oldest person in the room, excuse me. Retired realtor and enjoying retirement a great deal. Moved back to Spokane because we fell in love with this place.
Hi, my name is Scott. I'm a retired police officer from the West Side. I now work at Gonzaga University. I run security for the department there and really enjoying Spokane.
My name is Tom. I have been married for 39 years, have four beautiful daughters and nine wonderful grandchildren. I work at Spokane County, been there for 26 years.
Okay, I'm Doug, hoping that working at Spokane Public Radio and hoping that we can make this discussion type of forum a regular part of Spokane Public Radio. And so thank you for being part of the pilot.
My name is Tom. That makes us stereo tonight. We have two Toms. Moved to Spokane in 1984. I've been in radio and television news for many of those years, a congressional press secretary for a while, and now work at the Spokane Association of Realtors. And Doug and I have been friends, colleagues, competitors over the years, and it's nice to be here behind a microphone with you again, Doug.
I'm Matt, and I'm a psychiatrist with Washington State University in the Elson S. Floyd College of Medicine. So right now, we are halfway through our first year for our first group of brand new medical students. And I can assure you one of my main missions is that behavioral health and understanding of mental health and addiction and pain and all that goes along with it will be integrated into their core curriculum.
Well, hi, I'm Philip Tyler. I am the former president of the Spokane NAACP. I currently work at Gonzaga as a campus security officer with Scott, my supervisor. I am known to be a community activist. I work to try to create a more beloved community in Spokane, and I'm happy to be here with my co-founder, Tom.
A pleasure, Phil.
And I am Meg. Meg Tyler, previously Meg Demand, and I own a company called Demand Results, and I am Phil Tyler's wife and support system lately. So, and I am the only female in the room, apparently.
Yeah, we need to work on that.
I'll work on that. I've tried to invite a couple, so our next plus one, I'll bring one.
Sounds good. So let's start. Our last conversation, we learned about a difficult situation in your family, Phil and Meg. So let's have you tell the story and start us off.
Yeah, so on Monday, November 27th, my oldest son, Devin, left me a message. And the message said he had stopped by the house to drop off some cookies because he knows his father has a sweet teeth, I should say. And he would routinely do that. And I didn't happen to be home that day. So he left them on the porch and he left the message that said, "Hey, I stopped by, Dad, to drop off some cookies for you. Sorry I couldn't see you. I love you, Dad." And I responded back to him via text. I was testifying at a city council meeting. And I told him I was sorry that I had missed him and that I loved him too. And that was the last message I got from my son, November 27th, because that following Wednesday morning, our neighbor, a longtime friend of ours that lived across the street from my old house that my son was renting with two other friends of his, young gentlemen, they were all around the same age, 22. She called to tell me that there were several fire trucks and sheriff's deputy vehicles at my home, and that I know what was going on. And of course, I told her I did not. I asked her if she could go check and see what the situation was while I jumped in the car and ran over there. And obviously, as a parent, I had a sense of foreboding, and I texted my son, Devin, immediately, to no avail. He didn't respond. I texted him again, no response. I called him, no response. Texted him and told him to call me. By then, I was at the house. We were only about four blocks away. And as I rolled up and I saw the scene, immediately I knew something was wrong. And as I stepped out of the vehicle, I was confronted by the deputies telling me not to go into our garage. And at that point, I knew. His mother, who had been there, came running out of the house and told me that Devin had took his life. And from that point forward, obviously, my day, my life changed. And as we sat there for some 4 hours, as they checked over the scene, collected evidence, etc., many thoughts went through my mind. I wanted to crawl into a shell. I wanted to keep crying because I was crying. I didn't want to be around people. But as we left the day and I spent some time at home just laying on my bed with my wife consoling me, I thought, you know, what am I going to do now? Luckily, Devin had left us some videotapes telling us not why he made the decision to take his life, but just for us not to grieve, for us to celebrate the 22 years we had on this earth with him, to make the 24 hours that were given each day better. How we could use those 24 hours in each day that were given to make someone else's life better. And as I sat and I watched those videos over and over for about a day and a half, I reached out to a parent by the name of Philip Martin, whose son had tragically taken his life just 5 weeks prior. And I was assigned the detail to be with him and his wife at Gonzaga. And I reached out to him and we spoke on the phone. We cried. We shared stories. He guided me through this. And one of the things he told me was, do what makes you feel right. If that means talking about it, then talk about it. And I started talking about it. And what was unique, at least to me, was that people hearing the story was healing for me. And that's really what brings me here today in this conversation.
Do you share 2 days, story? 3 days after your son's passing, you were on the front page of the newspaper. How did that happen?
The media had reached out to me, and I had a relationship with several of our people in the media, and they heard about the situation. They reached out to me, and they asked if I would be willing to talk about it, because I had shared a video on Facebook, because I'd been inundated with calls and texts, but I wasn't really ready to communicate with anyone for a while. And I thought, well, this can get the message out as to why I'm not responding and what's going on without me having to communicate with the individuals that had been calling me. So when they saw that, they reached out to me. And by then, I had already spoken with Mr. Martin, as I had described, and I was ready to tell my story because I knew there were other people out there that were hurting. There were other people out there that might have been thinking about this, and I wanted to make sure that I used our tragedy to help others.
This is Tom. I saw your video when it was posted, and I want to tell you what that meant to me on the receiving end. I can't imagine what it meant for you, but it connected us. And I thought, as a friend of yours, that's where I needed to be, connected with you. Maybe I couldn't hug you. Maybe I couldn't say anything with you or to you, but I knew that we were connected, and I knew that you had all of these memories and things flooding back to you, and friends left and right embracing you and the video that you posted. But that gave us a way, me, a way to connect and to be sympathetic to your situation and somehow support you, be with you, all of those bewildering emotions. When a friend hurts, you want to be there for him. And that was the closest way of being there for you. And how did that virtual reality help you appreciate the fact that you are surrounded then and now by friends who love you, respect you, and wish only well for you?
Yeah, I will tell you this. This is a, first of all, it's a group that no parent wants to be a part of, first and foremost. But the outpouring of care, the outpouring of compassion from friends, from coworkers, from the entire community, the Gonzaga community, our friends at Spokane Talks Online, really helped to bring me from a dark place that I was heading down to. And this is why it's important for me to share this story, because none of us should have to do this alone. And none of us has to do this alone. It's okay to ask for help. It's okay to reach out. And I don't need Tom to be everything all at one time. I might need Tom just to be a friend. I might need Dr. Layton to be a counselor. I might need Scott to be an advocate for me. I might need Doug to be that voice to get my message out. And I think that's what's important, and that's what's helping me, and it's been helping others that we've come in contact with so much in hearing the story shared.
You're listening to our Spokane Plus One discussion group talk about suicide and grieving. This is the Inland Journal from Spokane Public Radio.
So, Meg, your wife is sitting to your right. So different people deal with things differently. How did you deal with it?
Myself, the day that it happened, I got a call from him. I was in a board meeting, and I knew, because he never calls me when I'm in a meeting. It's a strict rule with him. I won't bug you when you're at work. So I knew he was calling, something was up. And so I went out and took the phone call, and he said, come home now. And he told me to come home to, he told me that Devin had shot himself. And at that point, I didn't know whether Devin was alive or not. The whole way home, had no idea. And I knew Devin lived in the home that we also own. And so I didn't quite know which home I was headed to, but I knew I was going to probably stop. And we're not very far apart. So, and when I saw, when I pulled up and I saw the vehicles that were there, I asked on my way in if he had passed, and was told at that point. So that was my first introduction to what had actually happened. I was hoping it was an accidental shot, something like that. But, and then for me, coming from a mom who's a nurse, and when I went into crisis mode completely, and I'm also like a complete logistics person, so it was making sure that everybody was doing the right things, being nice to each other. I mean, because this could be, we're dealing with a lot of family that comes from a lot of different places. And so there was a lot of different people there, and just everybody was wonderful and trying to do what they needed to do. And so I honestly was just in the background, just trying to make sure that people had a glass of water or, you know, just the little logistic things. Because being Devin's stepmother for only about 2 years, really, or being in his life for not very long, and dealing with a stepmother who had been there for 16 years, and then dealing with his mother who was there all of his life, I wanted to make sure that those two were taken care of the most, because they were very affected, and making sure that he was okay, and making sure that Dalen, his other son, was okay. So I brought his other son to the scene. He immediately wanted to go into that garage and see what happened. And so my main focus was trying to keep everybody away from the scene as well. And so one of the things that they wanted to do was going there. And so I kind of had to make a few phone calls to the sheriff. He's the only one that Philip really listens to. And the sheriff was the only one that could convince them not to go in and see that. That wasn't the last version that they wanted to see. So, and then we had a lot of very good friends that came to the scene. Brian Schaefer, the fire chief, was there, and it was just really wonderful about cleaning up the scene. And so we could actually say goodbye that day as well. And so it was a really surreal day. So for me, it was just kind of stepping back and just making sure that he was okay. And then the next few weeks was just the same. Just whenever he needed to cry, let him cry. I think the most important conversation that he had was with the Gonzaga student who had committed suicide 5 weeks before, speaking to his father. And Phil Martin was the gentleman that said to him, and he took that. I mean, he's a very good soldier, takes what he says to do, and that's what he did. He said, don't blame yourself. He said, do what you need to do. And I listened to that conversation too, and so that's what we did. And honestly, I think that that propelled this Philip so much closer to being able to talk to the public. And he does real well at speaking to the public, so I think that that was part of his journey on healing. So that's how he could speak so candidly 2 days after, or 3 days after, I think.
You're 6 weeks out.
Now? Are we?
6 weeks. I've done some calculation.
Yeah.
How have you progressed? Where are you compared to 4 or 5 weeks ago?
Boy, it is a journey. There's ups, there's downs, there's guilt, there's sadness, there's guilt when you're not feeling sad. But the gift, if I can use that term, that this tragedy has brought to our family, is it's brought us closer together. And even though we have to suffer through the holidays, it has told me and showed me that truly what's important in life is not stuff. Is not material things. It is the people and the relationships that you've established that really care for you. When this happened, I really had questions about going back to work, if I was going to go back to work at all. And the outpouring from the Gonzaga community, from my immediate team, Scott, and my other supervisors, to my coworkers, to the entities that work on the campus, to the president himself, truly changed my mind. It showed me the caring. You always want to believe that you work in an environment where people care for you and you like one another. But this really showed me and my family that they truly loved us. And that has been so helpful and so healing. And then to meet with people like Dr. Layton, Tom, this evening when we come in and them sharing things that have helped them get through situations has been beneficial. And you realize the commonality that we all have, how these tragedies touch everyone in some way, shape, or form. And that's really gotten us through this time.
Phil, you mentioned that Tom said something as you were coming into the studio tonight, and I'm curious to hear directly from Tom what that was. Can you share?
Yeah, absolutely. One of my daughters was having twins this summer. We found out she had what's called twin-to-twin transference syndrome, where the umbilical cord is basically just a mess. Most all of the nutrients in the blood go into the one baby, and then after that, feed into the other baby, which puts everyone in stress, including my daughter. She was diagnosed with that, drove over to Seattle, had surgery the next day to repair that. We thought the surgery went well. Both babies seemed to be gaining weight at about the same rate, which was the real concern. She was on bed rest for 6 weeks in the hospital, and then on July 3rd delivered 3 months early, twins that weigh 2 pounds, 2 ounces each, Andrew and Benjamin. And it was a struggle. Being that young, their lungs were not developed well enough to be on the outside. Everything. Every day was a struggle. But they were making some progress. And about 4 weeks, Andrew took a turn, and it didn't look like he was going to come back. He had had a stroke, some pretty bad brain bleeding, and the doctors finally gave him a prognosis that he would not have any type of life. They could keep him alive for a little bit longer, but he would be a vegetable the whole time. So finally, on August 15th, my daughter and son-in-law made a decision that I would never want to have had to make, to have him pulled off of everything. Held him in their arms, and all of us as a family sat there and watched him pass away. As I shared before we started tonight, at that point in time, a little bit after that, I went out to the parking garage at Sacred Heart, and I sat on the ledge of the parking garage, and I was ready to throw myself over that ledge because I hurt so bad. I still don't believe I wanted to die, but I wanted to end the pain. The pain was just intolerable at that point in time. Thankfully, calmer heads prevailed, or a calmer voice upstairs spoke to me, and I didn't act on it. But I even remember feeling on the way home, if I hit that telephone pole hard enough, it would take care of it. And we weren't as vocal in our family about what went on. We all kind of went into our little shell. But about a week later, my wife and I finally sat down and talked how we were both feeling. And she had gone through exactly those same emotions. She had gone out to the parking garage herself. She had thought if she just went over the edge, it would all be done. We are about as bland, middle-class folk as you can be. We have no propensity for this. This has never happened in our family before, to think about suicide. But it would not have taken me that much that day to act on it.
Have you shared those thoughts with your daughter and your son-in-law?
Absolutely.
And what do they think?
They're amazing kids. They truly are amazing kids. And they feel very sorry that we were that distraught, is what they're worried about. They're worried about mom and dad. We're just the opposite. We're trying to do everything for them. My wife is babysitting now so my daughter can go back to work at WSU 4 hours a day. So we've got a great system. I'm blessed with a wonderful family. Wonderful family all around them. All of my kids are here in town, and again, just truly have everything to live for, except on that day.
This is a special hour-long Inland Journal from Spokane Public Radio. Our topic is suicide and grieving. Let's take a short break.
Let's rejoin our conversation.
So let's pull this out to the 20,000-foot level. Matt Layton, WSU. So you've heard the story of Phil. You've heard the story of Tom. Two different situations, two different cases. Are these typical? How do people deal with suicide generally?
Thankfully, even though it's increasing in frequency, it's still a rare event from the standpoint of... It's it happens more than we might realize. For example, in Spokane County, last year we had 98 suicides in 1 year. And those are only the ones that are confirmed by the medical examiner, where they take jurisdiction and make the determination. And it's only called suicide if there's a note, or if it was witnessed, or if there's reason to believe that they had previously been suicidal. So many end up accidental. Cause of death can be accidental or undetermined. So I was on a two-hour conference call today with the Department of Health Working Group on suicide prevention. You may or may not know that Governor Inslee created a task force to address suicide prevention as one of the statewide health problems, and the Secretary of the Department of Health is convening that. And so I'm a part of that task force. And so we're looking at the data, and what we're saying is we need to understand the quality of the data, number one, and how this is increasing. There's no question about it. The rate among veterans is astounding. And there's no other way to put it. And we were talking earlier about combining the number of suicide deaths with the number of accidental overdose deaths with opioids, including heroin, and how devastating that is. And we had 115 of those in Spokane County last year that were separate from confirmed suicides. So the impact on those 200-plus families who lost that loved one to suicide or to an accidental overdose, it's indescribable. And as Meg pointed out, Phil is amazingly articulate in being able to express his thoughts and feelings in a time when a lot of people are so overwhelmed with numbness, they don't know what to say or what to do. And that pain, as you said, Tom, the anguish is so intense that they just want it to stop. So I think that, to respond, Doug, I think anything in that situation could be considered a normal response, because who can say what is normal in a situation like that? And what we need to be doing is staying connected, as you pointed out, which is one of the main things that can potentially prevent suicide and help those who've been through such a horrible tragedy, is to fight that urge to withdraw and to isolate and instead stay connected, because as you work through that, it will be better in the long run.
So I'm curious, Phil, as a former law enforcement, current law enforcement officer, have you dealt on a professional level with other people dealing with suicide? And how are you taught as a law enforcement officer to work with others who are in that same situation you found yourself in?
Yeah, it's ironic that you asked that, because the story that I spoke with about Mr. Martin, that simply was that 5 weeks prior to Devin taking his life. And really, you know, and I'll let Scott talk to it more professionally from a Gonzaga standpoint, but we're taught to be empathetic. We're taught to provide them what they need, allow them time to talk, listen, and really don't, you know, question how they might respond or react to it. You know, from a military standpoint, from working at the Spokane County Sheriff's Office in the jail division, I've seen it. I've worked on individuals with CPR, you know, for multiple minutes, trying to save their life, and then having to deal with their families afterwards, coming and discussing it. And it takes a toll on those that are involved in those situations. And the one thing I would say, and again, I would turn it back over to Scott, was Gonzaga provided a resource for me, even when I had to deal with Mr. Martin and his family, about how it would impact me. And now they're moving even more so down the line with providing mental health training for those first responders that have to deal with those situations on a routine basis.
Let me pick up where Phil is leaving off here with you, Scott. We talked about what friends mean in the equation, but there's the larger circle of family, not necessarily blood family, but work family. How important can that be in this process of healing and recovering and moving towards tomorrow?
Yeah, I think it's a real critical piece. I think in this society, as we move from city to city, to chasing job to job, trying to find a place to call home, our extended family becomes so important. That social media piece becomes important. Staying connected is a real critical piece, I think. Not all people meet the need, and I think Phil was real articulate when he said, you know, Tom, perhaps you can talk me through this, or you can be my voice. Having a broad, wide network, and I think one of the things that really, I hope, helped Phil was having that broad network in play early and just full court press, trying to help Phil through this moment. You know, I think it's important to recognize that the people that do respond to help families in crisis in these moments, if they're empathetic, they're feeling that too. So those first responders, you know, they're feeling the pain of the family, and they're really trying to help along too. And don't discount that. And if you ever find yourself in crisis, those resources are really important in those critical moments, like you talked about, Tom. Hey, right now I'm feeling a particular way. I'm feeling at risk. Let me engage 911. Let me engage somebody right away.
I've done quite a bit of work with secondary trauma. And so it doesn't matter if you're in law enforcement, the Washington State Patrol, whether you're an emergency room nurse, having dealt with pediatric trauma. And what we know from the ways to try to deal with that is that the best medicine is a supportive work environment and training and preparation and talking about what does it mean to listen and what does it mean to be empathetic, and actually going through workplace trainings helps that group support each other through some of the just most horrible experiences you can imagine.
And as a supervisor in this circumstance, we approach this from a perspective like, Phil, whatever you need, whatever it is, however long you need, we are there to support you and get you through this. We love you. We want you to come back. We want you to come back and be with us on a daily basis, right? And my advice to anybody that finds themselves in that position as a supervisor, to extend that as much as you can, give that support, give that open door policy, that green light policy, to take whatever steps you need to do to make yourself better, to come back and be back in that immediate extended family.
And if I can offer from my own experience, Scott, don't turn to an employee handbook to find chapter and verse of how to respond and how to feel. Be human first.
Well said, Tom.
And however it comes out is human and genuine and real. And then tomorrow you can look at the book and decide, how do we cover this spot? How do we cover these slots? But be human in the first place.
Got it. Perfect. Spot on, Tom. Agreed. 100%.
I've been on both sides, so I kind of know how that feels.
You're listening to a discussion about suicide and grieving on Inland Journal from Spokane Public Radio, and there's more to come. But first, Tom MacArthur tells us about the group of people participating in this discussion.
Phil and I formed this group about a year ago with the idea that we were different yet had so much in common. And then we thought, let's invite a friend. So we added one and added two and added three. And the name of this group then became Spokane Plus One. Each of us would bring one and bring an idea or bring a topic. And here we are with a radio program, thanks to Doug and the facilities of KPBX, realizing how different we are, and yet at the same time, how much we have in common. That's what strikes me of the conversation we're having here today. I've learned things about people around these tables that I didn't know before, and it makes me appreciate the humanness that is in each of us. And if this program can communicate that central thought, you know, find ways to be common, find ways to be in common, and individually extraordinary, then maybe those folks who are thinking of ending it all, of jumping off the ledge or grabbing the next gun, might think twice about what else is in the equation. You know, what else can I offer? What could be my plus one? Because if you end it, it's a minus one. And how sad is that? So maybe the conversation could be beyond this room to plus one in your own life. You know, add something to tomorrow. Add one more day, one more hour, one more friend, and keep it going. Don't end it.
If you have thoughts about what you've heard in this program, send them to inlandjournal@kpbx.org or call our listener line at 509-232-6904. We invite people to be part of a future Spokane Plus One radio discussion. Let us know if you're interested, and we'll give the contact information again at the end of the program. Now let's rejoin the discussion.
Joe kidded earlier in the conversation that he's the oldest man in the room, so I'd like to take advantage of that point of view here, Joe, if we might. When you were fighting in the Vietnam War back in the 70s, we didn't have words to articulate some of these emotions of PTSD and trauma and stress and pain. How have we as a society moved from that world where you were a young man to the world that you see around you today? With social media, contacts are different. Vocabulary is different. Share that perspective of how we've matured as a race.
Well, you know, it's a great point, because when I came back from Vietnam, there was no welcome. In fact, there was a lot of disdain and anger toward those of us that had served. But I think, to answer your question, what has happened is this multiple means of communication among ourselves, mostly electronic anymore, it seems, which in itself is a two-edged sword, because it does give us great ways to communicate, but it also takes away the personal touch. Relating that to my own experience, I told you this before, our daughter-in-law committed suicide 2 years ago next month when her child was 2 months old. The hard part of it was, this was our youngest son. His first wife had died from diabetes, so he had lost two wives. This particular woman knew she was in trouble after the baby was born, was getting help daily, knew she had trouble. My wife, we were traveling at that time, living in our RV full time, and she flew to Minneapolis to visit 1 month after the baby was born. The doctors had warned our son, do not leave the baby alone with her. And so our focus was trying to keep her well, keep her stable, and communicate that, because my wife couldn't stay and we had to come back. And then our son's kind of by himself. And a couple of weeks later, after holding him at gunpoint for an hour, she took her life with her gun. And then our worry was him. Having lost two young wives, where was he? And it was amazing, because he totally focused on his son. Totally. That grandson got all of his attention. That's what, because he had no one to help him care for his son. And so he got on with life, and that's what you have to do, whether it's by communicating and speaking out and talking about it. But if you stay in and of yourself, like Tom was talking about, where it's just you, because I've been there after coming back and suffering some PTSD and standing in front of a gun cabinet and thinking, which one should I use? You think you're by yourself. You think there's nothing beyond where you are right then and there with that weapon. And you have to find ways, I believe, and we have to find ways to help people get beyond the here and the now in this very moment, and to understand that communication is far better than it's ever been. I'm not sure our feelings have grown as well as our communication systems have grown, our feelings for one another. I think it takes something like this for us to recognize how important it is to find ways to add value to other people's lives, to help them get through those things, even if it's just a couple of words, even if it's just a text or a tweet or whatever it happens to be, of, hey, I'm here, I recognize what's going on. You don't have to say much beyond that, I don't think. And so for us, what has happened is a new lady came into our son's life, who stepped in and became our grandson's mother immediately with no reservation at all. And so that, and then being able to communicate well, that they moved here from Minneapolis. So now we have another grandson. So those are when you look at it and you, the biggest problem we're having now is dealing with this, how could she miss out on this and watching this little man grow? How could she do that? And there's not an answer. And that was the one thing that we fortunately have a very close friend who is a psychiatrist in Southern California, and she deals mostly with Hollywood. She got on the phone with us and spent a lot of time with us talking us through, you don't need an answer. I know you feel like you need an answer, but there is no answer. There is not an answer. And so you got to get beyond that and get on with, somebody's got to raise this child. Somebody's got to focus on that family. Somebody's got to focus on your youngest son. And you guys are in a perfect position to do that. And so that really helped us a great deal to get beyond this being stuck. You feel like you can't go beyond lying in bed and shedding the tears or diving into a bottle. You get so stuck with that and so focused on why, and there is no answer.
You know, Joe, as you were talking, I was thinking about, you know, your daughter-in-law was, what, 20s?
Yeah.
I was thinking about, what about those kids who were 13, 14, 15 years old, have been bullied at school, abused at home? How do we give them the tools they need in order to be able to deal with that? I mean, it's hard enough as an adult when you've got a fully formed mind. But Matt, you know this as well as anybody. When you've got a teenager whose mind is still, you know, going 28 different directions, how do you give the tools to somebody who's younger, who says, I got nothing to live for?
My children are 16, 14, and 11, and my joke is that adolescence is a disorder, and the idea is to get through it. We used to think that you were mature when you're 18, and your brain was developed, and then it was 21, and then it was 25, and now it's when you learn to respect your parents. To me, it's the presence and the being there that a 14-year-old... I have a 14-year-old daughter, I have a 16-year-old son. And the things that come out of their mouth a lot of times aren't what they mean. And they don't have the right words and the ability to link up what they're saying with what they're feeling. And so a lot of times you have to deal with the resistance that comes with wanting to pull back because you can't articulate how you're feeling at that age. But the being there, as you were saying earlier, Scott, that presence, the connectedness, and the I don't know what to say, but I'm here. And in adolescence, that presence, that consistent, good morning, how are you? Eventually, at least for my kids, it wears them down and they come around and talk to me.
I dealt with a psychologist a number of years ago that was into talking about motivation and those kind of things. And his basic mantra was, nothing matters until you make it matter. So with teenagers, I think we've got to make them matter. We parents, the peers, teachers, administrators, we've got to make each and every one of them matter. I'm reading a great book right now called How the Mind Works. And what this guy talks about is he's developing artificial intelligence and he's trying to find ways to get computers to think. But as part of that, they're analyzing human being and the human process and how our minds work. And the interesting thing that he pointed out to me, and it just hit me right in the face, we are 99.9% alike. All of us humans, we all have a skeletal structure. We all have the same muscles. We all have brains. Our brains pretty much function the same way. 99% of the time, that 0.1% is we have different skin color, we have different eye color, we have different hair structure, but 99.9% of all the people in this world are exactly alike. So what we need to focus on is not so much the 0.1%, but how we are so much alike, how we all are in all this together. We're not in this alone. We're all together. We're all the same. So that's a really important message to me.
This is Inland Journal from Spokane Public Radio, and you're listening to a discussion about suicide and grieving.
Your comments harken back to conversations we've had at other sessions where we've talked about with our Spokane Plus One concept of what can you add to the conversation. I would almost suggest that what can you draw out of others to add to the conversation? How can you make that outreach now? How can you get that 14-year-old to spend 3 or 4 more minutes with you talking through things? Build those relationships. Gosh, it can't hurt. Only make this world a little more hospitable, right? A little more caring. So that would be my suggestion.
And I'll give a shout out to SMILE, which is Students Mastering Independent Life Skills Education. I'm on the advisory board, and Christy and Ted Torabara, their son Craig took his life at 19. And what they have done is create an advisory board that includes student representatives. And so we want to hear their voice at the table. And it's the same with our new medical students. They're providing feedback about what we have created for them. And my response is, thank you. You're now part of planning our better future. Until you were here, we can create the best curriculum and plan that we have, but until you're actually using it, we don't get that input. And so now they're collaborating with us and communicating in a professional way, using the proper venues. And adolescents are perfectly capable of doing that if we allow them, invite them, and then if we're patient enough to let them do it.
Matt, as long as we're talking about tomorrow and resources, what resources do we have here in the Eastern Washington community? Is there a phone number? Is there an office? Is there, where do we go?
There are, and I want to just take a moment to say that there was a very good piece of news in the Spokesman Review today about President Trump signing a package for veterans to receive seamless mental health care during the first 12 months of being integrating back into society if they have a mental health crisis. I'm always eager to hear of those initiatives within the VA, and I want to see that happen. I really want to see that come to fruition. But that's just one example, and that was just in the paper today. We do have First Call for Help, which is the crisis line here. I was the medical director at Spokane Mental Health for 9 years and got to work very closely with some of the most amazing, dedicated first responder mental health professionals who work with law enforcement, who work with firefighters out in the scene. And so that number is actually 509-838-4428, and that's First Call for Help, Spokane Frontier Behavioral Health, again, 509-838-4428. And there, if you want to volunteer, if you would like to provide a service in some way you don't know what else to do, you can sign up for shifts and actually be on the receiving end of those crisis line calls, and it can be life-changing, I tell you.
Meg, I want to circle around and come back to you. We think of this idea as women's intuition, and I don't mean to put you on the spot here as a woman, but how has the idea of emotional contact between you and Phil, how have you been able to communicate without words during this situation, to know what you need from each other to process this situation without asking the why, but about asking, what do you need? How can I be there for you? How has that process evolved between the two of you now as a newly married husband and wife?
That's a great question, because it is, and Phil and I have been together about 5 years now, and so, but this has been a completely different read from him. I've learned to just kind of sit back and watch and let him go what he need, go through what he needs to. He might have a different opinion of how I've helped, but this is kind of, and when we went through all of the interviews, it was scary to me to have him talk to the public so early, and it concerned me a little bit, but I knew deep down that this is how he needed to deal with it. And so it was a a grand stand back, don't do anything, be there if he starts to waver or anything, just put my hand on his shoulder. There was a lot of unspoken words, I feel like, between he and I, and I've had to learn how to be very patient very quickly. I'm not real good at that at all, but know when to pick and choose my battles with him. And I knew that he was going to go up and down through emotions. And even now, after the first couple weeks, it felt like we had just cried everything out so much. And we had had, like, we would go through a day and not cry. And we'd look at each other at night and, like, we made it through the day without crying. And so that was a big deal for us. And it was almost like we were kind of getting through. And then last Saturday was Devin's birthday, and that was the big milestone as well. And so that it brought us back to kind of how we felt the first 2 weeks when we had to go through the event and then planning the celebrations of life. That was a long week in between those two things. And then just revisiting that on Devin's birthday. And I feel like that's probably what we'll be going through, because people have told us from day one, this is going to be not just like a daily thing or a day thing or a week or a month. This is going to be a process for at least a year. And I have to kind of remind myself, okay, yeah, here's the hill. We were going down, now we got to go back up. So, yeah, so I think that that's just what we're in for, and that's what we both signed up for when we said our vows. So I feel like, you know, this is a really quick test for us right off the bat, since we just got married in September, or August. Whoops. So yeah.
We have to honor Devin because it's his spirit that convened us tonight. That needs to be said, I think. And also I wanted to quote Phil. What I understand to be the last words that he left us was, "Life is chaos, be kind." How did those words come to be? How did you discover them, and what do they mean to you today?
Yeah, we discovered them a week prior to Devin taking his life. He was coming home from work, and he had, as he described, a whole plate of food with him that he was going to smash when he got home, he said. But as he drove home, he saw a homeless gentleman, he described, with multiple layers of clothing on. It was November. It was cold. It had snowed by then, trying to stay warm. And as he stopped at the stoplight and looking over at the gentleman, he said, "I'm just going to give this plate of food to him. He needs it more than I need it." And he brought the gentleman into a establishment that was close to the intersection he stopped at, took a picture for Prosperity, and sent the picture to Meg and I via text and said, you know, "Hey, I was going to eat this food. I saw this guy. I thought it would be more appropriate for him to have it than me. It was early Thanksgiving, one stranger to another." He said, "What if we all did that? How different could it be?" And he said, "Everyone needs that one chance." And he said, "Life is chaos. Be kind." And that was the first time we had heard that from him. And then he spent Thanksgiving with us, and he wrote it on our refrigerator. It still remains there to this day. He just wrote up there, "Life is chaos, be kind, love you, Dad." And really that message in the video has resonated with me over and over again, and I watch it and think about it, because I think that we're not kind enough to those individuals that might be suffering through what we don't know. And even if you don't know what they're suffering through, just your kindness might change their decision-making. And so I think it's really important, and I live that to this day, just to be kind to everyone. Whether it's walking into an elevator, whether it's opening a door for someone, you don't know what that singular kind act from one person could do to change their life and change their trajectory. And that's how I look at it, Tom.
If he could join the conversation tonight, what would he contribute?
Boy, well, I can tell you what he said on the video. I don't know if I can say it on the radio, but he said, if each of us thought about the other, your neighbor, your coworker, your friend, your family, and we treated everyone with kindness, he said, excuse my language, shit would be amazing. And I think he would contribute an amazing, articulate voice in this conversation, urging us, imploring us, demanding us to be kind to one another in an environment that is going just the opposite sometimes, to be kind. I think that's what he would add, Tom.
This brings up a really important subject for me, and you know about it, is the philosophy called go-giving, where your worth as a human being can only be measured by how much value you add to other people's lives. That's it. There isn't another way to measure your worth as a human. And being kind is adding value. Finding ways and asking yourself the question, and obviously Devin asked that question, how can I add value to this man on the street? And he had something right there that made it easy for him to answer that question. It's not always easy to answer, but I find just a nice comment about somebody's eyes or their hair or a blouse they have on or a shirt or a tie, just acknowledging that. So many people go through there all day and never hear a kind word, much less a gesture of food. So that's an important aspect of this, is find ways to add value and ask yourself that question. How can I add value to this? How can I add value to this person right now?
I think that if we can add, not only when you say a nice, kind word to someone else, I think internally it makes us kind to ourselves as well, and it makes ourselves happy. So sometimes I was frustrated with you, I think, one day or something, and it was really, and I was just saying to myself over and over, just try and be kind, just try and be kind. And it's really hard when you're in a really cranky mood. But even if you are kind to someone else, it can change your own mood right back around. So that's another way I think Devin would also say being kind also helped him be kind. And we found out afterwards that Devin had actually helped quite a few friends get out of suicidal situations. He'd stayed up late and talked other people out of it, which is so interesting how he decided to end his own life. But and when he was talking in the videos, he was such at peace with the decision that he had made. And it was like I kind of say that he's kind of an angel, that he knew that this was my time on earth, and he did what he needed to do when he was here, and it was just time for him to go. So in a way, that makes me feel peaceful, not necessarily having a why behind it. That was his why. I did what I needed to do when I was here on earth, and now it's time for me to watch over you. And that's when he was telling his father, he said, just celebrate me, Dad, because I'm going to be looking down on you.
You've been listening to a discussion of our Spokane Plus One group, talking about suicide and grieving. I want to thank my fellow group members for being a part of this pilot radio program. We hope to do more respectful discussions on the radio on a variety of other topics. If you're interested in participating in a future program, let us know with an email to inlandjournal@kpbx.org. Or leave a message on the Spokane Public Radio listener line at 509-232-6904.
Thank you for your support of Inland Journal and Spokane Public Radio. If you didn't hear the whole program or you want to listen again, the podcast is available at SpokanePublicRadio.org. Music in this program was performed by String Space. Thanks to my co-host Tom MacArthur, I'm Doug Nadvornik.